Disc 8.
She was wearing boots, like paratrooper boots, like steel-toed black leather boots, military boots. And she had on a big camouflage t-shirt.
The darkness swallows him, seems to swallow him whole, swallows more of him than he knew he had.
Nothing else, just that. And I was just sort of shocked and didn't know why she was dressed like that. I didn't think nothing of it, not the way you might think. Then she shut the door behind me and put her hands on me.
Where did she put her hands on you?
She said she'd wanted me the minute we walked in that morning, he says, embellishing a little, but not a lot, because whatever her exact words were, the message he got was just that.
She wanted him. She had wanted him the first instant she saw him when he and Scarpetta showed up at her house to ask about Jilly. You said she put her hands on you. Where? What part of your body?
My pockets. In my pockets.
Front or back pockets?
Front.
His eyes drop to his lap, and he blinks as he looks at the deep front pockets of his black cargo pants. The same pants you have on now? Scarpetta asks, her eyes never leaving him.
Yeah, these pants. I didn't exactly get around to changing my clothes. I didn't exactly get back to my room this morning. I got a cab and went straight to the morgue.
We'll get to that, she replies. After she put her hands in your pockets, then what?
Why do you want to know all this?
You know why. You know exactly why, she says in that calm, steady tone, her eyes on him. He remembers Suze's hands digging deep into his pockets, and her pulling him into her house, laughing, saying how good he looked as she pushed the door shut with her foot. A fog swirls in his thoughts, like fog swirling in the headlights as a taxi drove him to her house, and he knew he was heading into the unknown, but he went. And then she had her hands in his pockets and was pulling him into the living room, laughing, dressed in nothing but a camouflage t-shirt and combat boots. She pressed against him, and he knew she could feel him, and she knew he could feel her soft and tight against him.
She got a bottle of bourbon out of the kitchen, he says.
And he listens to his voice, but he isn't seeing anything inside the hotel room as he tells Scarpetta. He's in a trance as he tells her.
She poured us drinks, and I said I shouldn't have any more. Maybe I didn't say that, I don't know. She had me going. What can I tell you? She had me going. I asked her, what's the thing with the camouflage? And she said he was into that, Frank was. Uniforms. He used to get her to dress up for him, and they would play.
Was Jilly around when he would ask Suze to wear uniforms and play?
What?
Maybe we'll get to Jilly later. What did Frank and Suze play?
Games.
Did she want you to play games last night? Scarpetta asks. The room is dark, and he feels the darkness, and he can't see what he did because it is unbearable, and all he can think about as he tries to be truthful is how the fantasy will die forever. She will imagine him, and it will never happen, never. And there will be no point in his ever hoping again, remotely hoping, because she will know what it might be like with him. This is important, Marino, she says quietly. Tell me about the game. He swallows and imagines he feels the pills in his throat, deep inside it and burning. He wants more tea, but can't move, and he can't bear to ask her to get him tea or anything else. She is sitting straight in the chair, but not tensely, her strong, capable hands on the armrests. She is erect but relaxed in her mud-spattered suit. Her eyes are keen as she listens.
She told me to chase her, he begins. I was drinking. And I said, what do you mean by chase? And she told me to go into the bedroom, her bedroom, and hide behind the door and to time it. She said for me to wait 5 minutes, exactly 5 minutes, and then start looking for her like I was going to kill her. And I told her it wasn't right. Well, I didn't really tell her.
He takes another deep breath.
I probably didn't tell her because she had me going.
What time was it by now?
I've been there maybe an hour.
She puts her hands in your pants the minute you walk through the front door at approximately 10:30, and then an hour passes? Nothing happened during that hour?
We were drinking, in the living room, on the couch.
He won't look at her now. You will never look at her again. Lights on, curtains open or closed.
She built a fire. The lights were off. I don't remember if the curtains were open.
He thinks about it.
They were closed.
What did you do on the couch?
Talked and made out, I guess.
Don't guess. And I don't know what that means. What does it mean when you say you made out? Scarpetta replies. Kissing? Fondling? Did you take your clothes off? Did you have intercourse? Oral sex? He feels his face turn hot.
No, I mean, the first part we did. Kissing, mostly, you know, making out, like people do. Making out. We were on the couch and talked about the game.
His face burns. He knows she can see how hot his face is, and he refuses to look at her. The lights were out, and the light from the fire moved over her flesh, her pale flesh. And when she grabbed him, it hurt and excited him.
And then it simply hurt.
He told her to be careful, because it hurt. And she laughed, and said she liked it rough, liked it very rough, and would he bite her? And he said no, he didn't want to bite her, not hard. You'll like it, she promised. You'll like biting hard. You don't know what you're missing if you've never done it rough. And all the while she talked, her flesh caught the light of the fire as she moved. And he tried to keep his tongue in her mouth and please her while he crossed his legs and maneuvered himself so she wouldn't hurt him. Don't be such a sissy, she kept saying as she tried to shove him down hard on the couch and force his zipper. But he managed to keep her from getting to him. He was thinking about her teeth showing white in the firelight, and what it would be like if she got those white teeth on him. The game began on the couch, Scarpetta asks from her distant chair.
That's where we talked about it. Then I got up, and she took me into the bedroom and told me to step behind the door and wait 5 minutes, like I said.
Were you still drinking?
She'd poured me another drink, I guess.
Don't guess. Big drinks? Little drinks? How many by now?
Nothing that woman does is in a small way. Big drinks. 3 at least by the time she told me to go behind the door. It starts getting really fuzzy now,
he says.
After the game started, it all starts to fade. Maybe it's a damn good thing.
It's not a good thing. Try to remember. We need to know the what. The what, not the why. I don't care about the why, Marino. Trust me. There's nothing you can tell me that I haven't heard before. Or seen. I don't shock easily.
No, Doc. I'm sure you don't. But maybe I do. Maybe I didn't think so, but maybe I do. I remember looking at my watch and having a real hard time seeing the time. My eyesight ain't what it used to be anyway, but it was blurring bad and I was keyed up, real keyed up, not in a real good way. I don't know why I went along with it, to tell you the truth.
He was sweating profusely behind the door, trying to read his watch. Then he started counting silently, counting up to 60 and losing his place and starting again until he was sure 5 minutes had passed. His excitement was not the sort he had ever felt with a woman. No woman or encounter with a woman he could recall. Not ever. He stepped out from behind the door and realized the entire house was dark. He couldn't see his own hands unless he held them very close to his face. And he felt along the walls and realized she could hear him. And this was when he realized in his drunken obtuseness, somehow as drunk as he was, he realized his heart was pounding, and he was breathing hard because he was excited and scared, and he doesn't want Scarpetta to know he was scared. He reached down to his ankle and lost his balance, and found himself on the hallway floor feeling for his gun, but his gun wasn't in its holster. He doesn't know how long he sat there. It's possible he fell asleep briefly. When he came to, he didn't have his gun, and his heart was pounding in his neck as he sat without moving, barely breathing, on the wooden floor, sweat streaming into his eyes, listening, trying to hear where the son of a bitch was. The darkness was so complete it was thick and airless, and it wrapped around him like black cloth as he tried to get to his feet without making noise and giving away his position. The bastard was in here somewhere, and Marino didn't have his gun. With his arms out like oars, he barely brushed the walls as he moved himself forward, listening, ready to pounce, knowing he was going to get shot if he didn't catch the piece of shit by surprise. He moved slowly like a cat, his brain focused on the enemy,
and the thought that kept coming to him was how did he get into the house, and what son of a bitch, and where was his backup? Where the fuck was everybody? Oh, Christ, maybe they were down. Maybe he was the only one left, and now he was going down because he didn't have his gun, and somehow he had lost his radio, and he didn't know where he was. And then he felt something hit him. And then he passed in and out of a heaving darkness, a hot darkness that drove the air out of him as it moved. And he became aware of pain, of burning pain, as the darkness moved and grabbed at him and made terrible, wet noises.
"I don't know what happened," he hears himself say.
And it surprises him that his voice sounds sane, because inside he feels crazy.
"I just don't know. I woke up in her bed."
"Clothed?"
"No."
"Where were your clothes, your belongings?"
"In a chair."
"In a chair? Neatly in a chair?"
"Yeah, pretty neatly. My clothes and my pistol was on top of them. I sat up in bed and nobody else was there,"
he says. "Was her side of the bed unmade? Did it look slept in?"
"The covers were pulled down and messed up, real messed up. But nobody was there. I looked around and I didn't know where the hell I was. And then I remembered I'd taken a taxi to her house. And I remembered her coming to the door dressed the way she was, you know, the night before. I looked around and saw a glass of bourbon on the table on my side of the bed and a towel. The towel had blood on it, and it scared the shit out of me. I tried to get up and couldn't. I just sat there. I couldn't get up."
He realizes his teacup is full, and it terrifies him that he has no recollection of Scarpetta getting up from her chair and refilling his tea, or if maybe he did, but he doubts he did. He has a sense that he is in the same position on the bed that he has been in, and he notices the clock, and more than 3 hours have passed since he and Scarpetta started talking in his hotel room. "Do you think it's possible she drugged you?" Scarpetta asks him. "Unfortunately, I don't think a drug test would be helpful at this point. Too much time has passed. It depends on the drug."
"Oh, that would be great. If I go get a drug test, then I may as well call the police myself, assuming she ain't already done it."
"Tell me about the bloody towel," she says.
"I don't know whose blood it was. Maybe it was mine. My mouth hurt."
He touches it.
"I hurt like shit. I guess that's what she's into, hurting. But all I can say is, well, I don't know what I did because I didn't see her. She was in the bathroom, and when I started calling out her name to see where the hell she was, she started screaming at me, screaming for me to leave her house, and saying she was saying all these things."
"I don't guess you thought to take the bloody towel with you."
"I don't even know how I managed to call a taxi to get out of there. In fact, I don't remember doing it. Obviously, I did. No, I didn't take the towel, goddammit."
"You came straight to the morgue." She frowns a little, as if this part doesn't make sense.
"I stopped for coffee. A 7-Eleven. Finally, I got the cab driver to drop me off several blocks from the office so I could walk, hoping I could clear my head. It helped a little. I felt half human again. And then I walked in the office and damn if she's not there."
"Before you got to the OCME, did you listen to your phone messages?"
"Oh, maybe I did."
"Otherwise, you couldn't have known about the meeting."
"No, I knew about the meeting," Marino says. "Eyes told me at the FOP lounge that he passed on some information to Marcus. An email, that's what he said."
He tries to remember.
"Oh, yeah. Now I know. Marcus was on the phone as soon as he opened the email and said he was going to have to call a meeting for the next morning. And he told Eyes to make sure he was in the building in case he needed him to come down and explain things."
"So you knew about the meeting last night," Scarpetta says.
"Yeah. Last night was the first I heard about it. And it seemed like I said something to make me think you was going to be there, so I knew I had to be there."
"You knew the meeting was to be at 9:30?
"I must have. I'm sorry I'm so foggy, Doc, but I knew about the meeting."
He looks at her and can't figure out what's going through her mind.
"Why? What's a big deal about the meeting?"
"He didn't tell me about it until 8:30 this morning," she replies.
"He's shooting bullets at your feet, making you dance," Marino says, and he hates Dr. Marcus. "Let's get us a plane and go back to Florida. Fuck him."
"When you saw Mrs. Paulson at the office this morning, did she speak to you?"
"She looked at me and walked off, like she didn't know me." "I don't understand nothing about this, Doc. I just know something happened, and it's bad. And I'm scared shitless. I did something really bad, and now I'm gonna get it. After all the shit I've done, now this is gonna do it. This is it.
Scarpetta slowly gets up from her chair, and she looks tired, but she is alert. And he can see the worry in her eyes. But he can also see she is thinking. She is making connections that he sure as hell isn't making. Her eyes are full of thoughts as she looks out the window and walks over to the service cart and drains a last little bit of tea into her cup. "She injured you, didn't she?" she says, standing near the bed, looking down at him. "Show me what she did to you."
"Hell no! Hell no, I can't!" he says in a whine that makes him sound 10 years old. "I can't do that! No way!"
"Do you want me to help you or not? You think you have something I've never seen before?" He covers his face with his hands.
"I can't do it."
"You can call the police, and they'll get you down to the station and photograph your injuries. Then you've just started a case. Maybe that's what you want. Not a bad plan, assuming she's already called the police. But I suspect she hasn't." He lowers his hands and looks up at her.
"Why?
Why do I suspect that? Very simple. People know we're staying here. Doesn't Detective Browning know you're staying here? Doesn't he have your phone numbers? So why haven't the police shown up to arrest you? You think they wouldn't be all over you if Jillie Paulson's mother called 911 and said you raped her? And why didn't she scream when she saw you at the office? You just raped her and she doesn't make a scene or call the police right then?"
"Ain't no way I'm calling the police," he says.
"Then I'm all you've got." She walks back to her chair and picks up her nylon scene kit. She unzips it and pulls out a digital camera.
"Holy shit,"
he says, staring at the camera as if it is a gun pointed at him. "Sounds like the victim here is you," she says. "Sounds like she wants you to think you did something to her. Why?"
"Shit if I know. I can't do it."
"You're hungover, but not stupid, Marino." He looks at her. He looks at the camera down by her side. He looks at Scarpetta standing in the middle of his room in her dark, mud-spattered suit. "We're here working the death of her daughter, Marino. Mama clearly wants some kind of leverage or money or attention or some kind of something, and I intend to find out what it is she wants. Oh, yes, I will find out. Take your shirt off, your pants off. Take off whatever you need to take off to show me what that woman did to you during her sick little game last night."
"Now what are you going to think of me?"
he says, pulling his black polo shirt over his head, carefully, the fabric hurting him where it rubs the bite and suck marks all over his chest. "God, sit still, God damn it! Why didn't you show me this earlier? We've got to take care of this or you're going to get infections. And you're worried about her calling the police? Are you out of your mind?" All this while she takes photographs, moving over him, getting close-ups of each wound.
"Thing is, I ain't seen what I did to her,"
he says, a little calmer, realizing that getting checked out by the doc might not be as bad as he thought. "You did even half of this to her, your teeth should hurt." He pays very close attention to his teeth, and feels nothing at all, just his usual teeth in the usual way they feel. Thank God his teeth don't hurt. "What about your back?" she asks, standing over him.
"It don't hurt."
"Lean forward. Let me look." He bends over and feels her carefully move the pillows away from his back. He feels her warm fingers between his shoulder blades, her hands lightly touching his bare skin and pushing him farther forward as she examines his back. And he tries to remember whether she's ever touched his bare back before. She hasn't. He would remember. "What about your genitals?" she asks, as if it is nothing. When he doesn't respond, she says, "Marino, did she injure your genitals? Is there something there I should photograph, not to mention treat, or are we going to pretend that I somehow don't know that you have male genitalia like half the rest of the human race? Well, obviously she hurt your genitals, or else she would simply tell me no, correct?"
"Correct," he mutters, covering his crotch with his hands. "Yeah, I'm hurting, okay? But maybe you got enough already to prove your point, to prove she hurt me, no matter what I did to her, assuming I did something."
She sits on the edge of the bed, not more than 2 feet from him, and looks at him. "How about a verbal description? Then we'll decide if you need to take your pants off."
"She bit me," All over. And I got bruises.
I'm a doctor, Scarpetta says.
I know that all right, but you ain't my doctor.
I would be if you died. If she'd killed you, who do you think would want to see you and know every damn thing about it? But you're not dead, for which I'm extremely grateful. But you got attacked and have the same sort of injuries you might have were you dead. And this all sounds perfectly ridiculous, even to me, even as I'm saying it. Will you please let me take a look and see if you need medical treatment and if we need to take photographs?
What kind of medical treatment?
Probably nothing that a little betadine won't cure. I'll pick some up at the drugstore. He tries to imagine what will happen if she sees him. She has never seen him. She doesn't know what he has, and he might not be above average or below average, and ordinarily, just being ordinary, will get one by. But he doesn't know what to expect, because he has no idea what she likes or is accustomed to. So it's probably not smart to take off his pants. Then he thinks of riding in the back of an unmarked car and being photographed in lockup and going to court. And he unbuttons his pants and pulls down the zipper.
If you laugh, I'll hate you the rest of your life, he says.
And his face burns hot, and he is sweating, and the sweat stings whatever it touches. You poor boy, she says. That crazy bitch, she says. Chapter 31. It is raining a cold, hard rain when Scarpetta pulls off to the side of the street and parks in front of Susanna Paulson's house. For a few minutes she sits with the engine running and the wiper blades sweeping back and forth, and she looks out at the uneven brick sidewalk that leads to the sloping porch and imagines Marino's path last night. She doesn't have to imagine much else. What he told her was more than he thinks. What she saw was worse than he knows. He may not believe he told her every detail, but he told her plenty. She turns off the wipers and watches the rain spatter the glass and run down it. And then it is raining so hard, all she can hear is a steady, wet splashing, and the water on the windshield looks like rippled ice. Susanna Paulson is home. Her minivan is parked near the sidewalk, and the lights are on in the house. She didn't walk anywhere in this weather. Scarpetta's rental car has no umbrella, and she doesn't have a hat. She gets out, and the smacking of water is suddenly louder, and rain dashes her face as she hurries along the slippery old bricks that lead to the house of a girl who is dead and a mother who is sexually insane. Perhaps it is overly dramatic to consider her sexually insane. Scarpetta reconsiders, but she is much angrier than Marino knows. He may not realize she is angry at all, but she is quite angry, and Mrs. Paulson is about to see what it is like when Scarpetta is angry. She firmly taps the brass pineapple against the front door and contemplates what to do if the woman refuses to open it, if she pretends she isn't home, like Fielding did. She taps the pineapple again, slower and harder. Night is coming quickly like a cloud of black ink because of the storm, and she can see her breath as she stands on the porch, surrounded by splashing water. And she raps again and again. I'll just keep standing here, she thinks. You're not getting out of this. Don't think there's a chance I'll turn around and leave. She pulls her cell phone and a scrap of paper out of her coat pocket and looks at a number she jotted down when she was here yesterday, when she was quiet and gentle with this woman, when she felt sorry for her. She dials and can hear the phone ring inside the house, and she raps the pineapple again as loud as she can. If the door knocker breaks, she doesn't care. Another minute passes, and she redials the number, and the phone rings and rings inside, and she hangs up before the answering machine begins. You're home, she thinks. Don't pretend you're not. You probably know it's me out here. Scarpetta steps back from the door and looks at the lighted windows along the front of the small brick house. Filmy white curtains are drawn across them, and they are full of soft, warm light, and she sees a shadow pass before the window on her right. She can see the outline of a person as it drifts past the window, pauses, then turns around and vanishes. She raps on the door again and redials. This time, when the answering machine picks up, Scarpetta stays on the line and says, Mrs. Paulson, it's Dr. K. Scarpetta. Please answer your door. It's very important. I'm standing outside your front door. I know you're home. She ends the call and raps some more. And the shadow moves again, this time past the window to the left of the door. And then the door opens.
Good heavens,
Mrs. Paulson says in feigned surprise that is unconvincing.
I didn't know who it was. What a storm. Come in out of the rain. I don't answer the door when I don't know who it is.
Scarpetta drips into the living room and takes off her long, dark, soaking wet coat. Cold water drips from her hair, and she pushes it off her face, realizing her hair is as wet as it would be had she just stepped out of the shower.
God knows you're going to get pneumonia,
Mrs. Paulson says to her.
Here I am telling you. You're the doctor. Come on in the kitchen and let me get you something warm to drink.
Scarpetta looks around the tiny living room, at the cold ashes and chunks of burned wood in the fireplace, at the plaid couch beneath the windows, at the doorways on either side of the living room that lead into other parts of the house. Mrs. Paulson catches Scarpetta looking, and a tightness comes over her face, a face that is almost pretty, but cheap and rough.
Why are you here?
Mrs. Paulson says in a different voice.
What are you doing here? I thought you might be here for Jilly, but I can see that's not it.
I'm not sure anybody was here for Jilly, Scarpetta replies, standing in the middle of the living room, dripping on the hardwood floor and looking around, making it obvious that she is looking around.
You have no right to say that,
Mrs. Paulson snaps.
I think you should leave right now. I don't need the likes of you in my house.
I'm not leaving. Call the police if you want. But I'm not going anywhere until we've had a conversation about what happened last night.
I should call the police, all right, after what that monster did. After all I've been through, and then he comes over here and takes advantage like that, going after someone who is hurting the way I am. I should have known. He looks the type.
Go on, Scarpetta says. Call the police. I have a story, too. Quite a story. If you don't mind, I believe I'll look around. I know where the kitchen is. I know where Jilly's room is. I presume if I head through this doorway and turn left instead of right, I might just find your bedroom, she says as she walks that way.
You can't just walk around my house,
Mrs. Paulson exclaims.
You get out of my house this minute. You have no cause to be snooping around.
The bedroom is bigger than Jilly's, but not much. In it are a double bed, a small antique walnut nightstand on either side, and two dressers crammed against a wall. A doorway leads into a small bathroom, and another doorway opens into a closet. And there, in plain view on the closet floor, is a pair of black leather combat boots. Scarpetta digs inside a pocket of her suit jacket and pulls out a pair of cotton gloves. She puts them on as she stands in the closet doorway looking down at the boots. She scans the clothes hanging from the rod and abruptly turns around and walks into the bathroom. Draped over the side of the tub, is a camouflage t-shirt.
He told you a story, didn't he?
Mrs. Paulson says from the foot of the bed.
And you believe him? We'll see what the police believe. I don't think they'll believe him or you.
How often did you play soldier when your daughter was around to see it? Scarpetta asks, looking right at her. Apparently Frank liked to play soldier. Is that where you learned the game, from him? Or are you the creator of this vile little charade of yours? How much did you do in front of Jilly? And who played the game with you when Jilly was here? Group sex? Is that who them is? Other people who played the game with you and Frank?
How dare you accuse me of such a thing,
she exclaims. And her face is twisted by contempt and rage.
I don't know a thing about any game.
Oh, there's plenty of accusing to go around. And there will probably be more, Scarpetta says, moving closer to the bed and with a gloved hand pulling back the covers. It doesn't look like you changed the linens. That's good. See the blood spots on this sheet right here? How much do you want to bet that comes back as Marino's blood, not yours? She gives her a long look. He's bleeding, and you aren't. Now, that's curious. I believe there's a bloody towel around here somewhere, too. She looks around. Maybe you've washed it, but it doesn't matter. We can still get what we need from something that's been washed.
I have this happen to me. And you're worse than he is,
Mrs. Paulson says, but her expression has changed.
I would think another woman would at least have a little compassion.
For someone who mauls another person and then accuses him of assault? I don't believe you'll find a decent woman on this planet who would have compassion for that, Mrs. Paulson. Scarpetta starts pulling the cover off the bed.
What are you doing? You can't do that.
I'm going to do that and more. Just watch. She strips off the sheets and rolls them and the pillows into the quilt.
You can't do that. You're not a cop.
Oh, I'm worse than any cop. Trust me. Scarpetta picks up the bundle of linens and places it on top of the bare mattress.
What next?
She looks around. You may not have noticed when you ran into Marino at the medical examiner's office this morning, but he had on the same pants that he had on last night, and the same underwear. All day, as a matter of fact. You probably know that when a man has sex, he is likely to leave at least a little something in his underwear and possibly even in his pants. But he didn't. He didn't leave a trace of anything in his underwear or pants, except blood from where you hurt him. You also may not know that people can see through your curtains, see if you're with someone, if you're fighting or having a romantic encounter, assuming you're still on your feet. No telling what the neighbors across the street have seen when your lights are on or you've got a fire going.
Maybe it started out all right between the two of us and got out of hand,
Mrs. Paulson says, and she seems to have made a decision.
It was innocent enough, just a man and a woman enjoying each other. Maybe I got a little carried away because he frustrated me, got me all dressed up with no place to go. He couldn't do it. A big man like him, and he couldn't do it.
I guess not when you kept filling his glass with bourbon, Scarpetta says. And she is pretty sure Marino didn't do it. She doesn't see how he could. The problem is, he still worries that he did it, and he worries that he couldn't, so there isn't much room for discussion with him. Scarpetta squats inside the closet and retrieves the boots. She places them on the bed, and they look very sinister and large against the bare mattress.
Those are Frank's boots,
Mrs. Paulson tells her. If you've worn them, your DNA will be inside them.
They're way too big for me.
You heard what I said. DNA will tell us a lot. She walks into the bathroom and picks up the camouflage T-shirt. I suppose this is Frank's as well. Mrs. Paulson has nothing to say. We can go into the kitchen now if you want, Scarpetta says. Something warm to drink would be nice. Maybe some coffee. What kind of bourbon were you drinking last night? You shouldn't feel very good right now either, unless you spent more time filling his glass than your own. Marino's in pretty bad shape today. Pretty bad. He required medical treatment. All this as Scarpetta walks briskly toward the back of the house, toward the kitchen.
What do you mean?
I mean, he needed a doctor.
He went to the doctor?
He was examined and photographed, every inch of him. He's not in good shape, Scarpetta says, walking into the kitchen and spotting the coffee maker near the sink, very close to where the bottle of cough syrup was the other day. The bottle isn't there now. It is nowhere in sight. She takes off her cotton gloves and tucks them in her suit pocket.
He ought to be after what he did.
You can stop that story now, Scarpetta says, filling the glass coffee pot with tap water. That story is a lie, and you may as well give it up. If you have injuries, let's see them.
If I show them to anybody, it will be the police.
Where do you keep the coffee?
I don't know what you're thinking, but it isn't the truth,
Mrs. Paulson says, opening the freezer and setting a bag of coffee by the pot. She opens a cupboard and finds a box of filters, letting Scarpetta help herself. Truth seems hard to find these days, Scarpetta replies, opening the coffee and placing a filter in the coffee maker, then measuring coffee with a small scoop she found in the bag. I wonder why that is. We can't seem to find the truth about what happened to Jilly. Now the truth about what happened last night seems to elude us. I'd like to hear what you have to say about the truth, Mrs. Paulson. That's why I decided to drop by tonight.
I wasn't going to say anything about Pete,
she says bitterly.
If I was going to, don't you think I would have? Truth is, I thought he had a good time.
A good time? Scarpetta leans against the counter and crosses her arms at her waist. Coffee drips, and the aroma of it seeps around the edges of the kitchen. If you look like he does today, I'm wondering if you'd think you had a good time.
You don't know what I look like.
I can tell by the way you move that he didn't hurt you. In fact, he didn't do much of anything. Not after all that bourbon. You just told me that yourself.
You got something with him? Is that why you're here?
She looks slyly at Scarpetta, an interest glints in her eyes. I have something with him, but it isn't something you're likely to understand. Did I mention to you that I'm also a lawyer? Would you like to hear what happens to people who falsely accuse someone of assault or rape? Have you ever been to jail?
You're jealous. I see what this is about.
She smiles smugly. Think what you want. But think about jail, Mrs. Paulson. Think about crying rape and the evidence proving you to be a liar.
I won't be crying rape, don't you worry,
she says, her face turning harder.
Nobody rapes me anyway. Let them try. What a big baby. That's what I have to say about him. A baby. I thought he would be fun. Well, I thought wrong. You can have him, Miss Doctor, or lawyer, or whatever you are.
The coffee is ready, and Scarpetta asks about cups, and Mrs. Paulson finds two in a cupboard, and then two spoons. They sip coffee standing up, and then Mrs. Paulson begins to cry. She bites her lower lip, and tears spill out and stream down her face, and she starts shaking her head.
I'm not going to jail,
she says. That would be what I prefer. I'd rather you didn't go to jail, Scarpetta says, sipping her coffee. Why did you do it?
It's personal what people do with each other.
She won't look at her. When you draw blood and bruise someone, it's not personal. It's a crime. Is rough sex a habit of yours?
You must be some kind of Puritan,
she says, wandering to the table and sitting down.
I guess there must be a lot you've never heard of.
You might be right. Tell me about the game.
Get him to.
I know what Marino has to say about your game, at least the one you played last night. Scarpetta sips her coffee. You've played your games for a while, haven't you? Did they start with your ex-husband, with Frank?
I don't have to talk to you,
she says from the table.
I don't see why I should.
The rose we found in Jilly's dresser. You said Frank might know something about it. What did you mean? She will not answer, and she looks angry and full of hate as she sits at the table and cradles the coffee cup in both hands. Mrs. Paulson, do you think Frank might have done something to Jilly?
I don't know who left the rose,
she says, staring at the same spot on the wall she stared at when Scarpetta was here yesterday.
I know I didn't. I know it wasn't there before, not out in her room, not where I could see it, and I'd been in her drawers. I went in them the day before, putting away laundry and things. Jilly was bad about putting things away. I was always picking up after her. I never saw anything like it. She couldn't put something back to save her.
She catches herself and falls silent, staring at the wall. Scarpetta waits to see if she will say more. What must be a minute passes, and the silence is heavy.
The worst thing was the kitchen,
Mrs. Paulson finally says.
Taking out food and just leaving it on the counter. Even ice cream. Can't tell you how much food I threw out.
Her face collapses into grief.
And milk. I was pouring milk down the sink because she left it out half the day.
Her voice rises and falls and shakes.
Do you know what it's like to pick up after somebody all the damn time?
Yes, Scarpetta says. That's one reason I'm divorced.
Well, he's not much better,
she says, staring off.
Between the two of them, that's all I did. Pick up.
If Frank did something to Jilly, what do you think it might have been? Scarpetta asks. And she is careful not to ask questions that can be answered with a simple yes or no. Mrs. Paulson stares at the wall, not blinking.
In his own way, he did something.
I'm talking physically. Jilly is dead. Her eyes fill with tears, and she roughly wipes them with a hand as she stares at the wall.
He wasn't here when it happened. Not in this house. Not that I know of.
When what happened?
While I was gone to the drugstore. Whatever it was happened then.
She wipes her eyes again.
The window was open when I came home. It wasn't when I left. I don't know if she opened it. I'm not saying Frank did it. I'm saying he has something to do with it. Everything he got near died or was ruined. Kind of funny to think that about someone who's a doctor. You should know.
I'm going to go now, Mrs. Paulson. I know this hasn't been an easy conversation. None of it has. You've got my cell phone number. If you think of anything that is important, I want you to call me. She nods, staring and crying. Maybe someone's been in this house before whom we ought to know about. Someone besides Frank. Maybe someone Frank had over. Someone he knew. Maybe someone who played the game. She doesn't get up from her chair as Scarpetta moves to the doorway. Anyone at all who might come to your mind, Scarpetta says. Jilly didn't die of the flu, she repeats. We need to know what happened, exactly what happened to her. We will know, sooner or later. I believe you'd rather have it sooner, wouldn't you? She just stares at the wall. You can call me any time, Scarpetta says. I'm going to go now. If you need something, you can call me. I could use a couple of large trash bags if you have them.
Under the sink? If they're for what I think, you don't need them, she mutters.
Scarpetta opens the cupboard under the sink and pulls four large plastic trash bags out of a box. I'll take them anyway, she replies. Hopefully, I won't need them. She stops by the bedroom and collects the balled-up linens, the boots, and the T-shirt, and places them inside the plastic bags. In the living room, she puts on her coat and steps back out into the rain, carrying four bags, two heavy with linens, the other two having nothing in them but a T-shirt and a pair of boots. Puddles on the brick walk splash over her shoes, and cold water soaks her feet, and the rain is half frozen as it slaps down all around her. Chapter 32. Inside the Other Way Lounge, it is very dark, and the women who work here have stopped giving Edgar Allan Poe sidelong looks that at first were curious, then disdainful, and finally indifferent, before stopping altogether. He picks at the stem of a maraschino cherry and takes his time tying it in a knot. He drinks Bleeding Sunsets in the Other Way, a specialty of the house that is a mixture of vodka and other stuff, as he thinks of it. Other stuff that is orange and red and drifts unevenly to the bottom of the glass. A bleeding sunset looks like a sunset until a few tilts of the glass mix the liquids and syrups and other stuff together, and then the drink is simply orangish. When the ice melts, whatever is left in his glass looks like those orange drinks he used to get as a kid. They were in plastic oranges, and he drank them out of green straws that were supposed to look like stems. And the orange drink was diluted and boring, but the plastic orange it came in always promised that the drink would be fresh and delicious. He would beg his mother to buy him one of the plastic oranges every time they came to South Florida, and every time he got disappointed again. People are like those plastic oranges and what's in them. People are one thing to look at and another thing to taste. He lifts his glass and swirls the orangish swill that is left in the bottom. He thinks about ordering another bleeding sunset as he calculates how much cash he has left and also takes into account his sobriety. He isn't a drunk. He has never been drunk in his life. He worries excessively about being drunk and can't drink a bleeding sunset or any other concoction without analyzing every ounce he swallows, worrying about the effect. He also worries about being fat, and alcohol is fattening. His mother was fat. She got fatter in time, and it was a shame because she had been pretty once.
"It runs in the family," she used to say. "You keep eating like that and you'll see what I mean," she used to say. "That's the way it starts, right around the middle," she used to say.
"I'll have one more," Edgar Allan Poe says to whoever might be listening.
The Other Way is like a very small clubroom scattered with wooden tables covered with black cloths. There are candles on the tables, but they have never been lit when he's here. In a corner is a pool table, but no one has played pool when he's here. And he suspects that the clients here are not interested in pool, and the scarred table with its red felt cloth might be left over from an earlier incarnation. Quite likely the Other Way was something else once. Everything was something else once.
"I believe I'll have one more," he says.
The women who work here are hostesses, not waitresses, and they expect to be treated like hostesses. Gentlemen drift in and out of the Other Way, and do not snap their fingers at the ladies, because they are hostesses and demand respect. So much respect that Pogue feels they are doing him a favor to let him come in and spend his money on their runny, bloody, bleeding sunsets. His eyes move in the dark, and he sees the redhead. She wears a skimpy, short black jumper that should have a blouse under it, but doesn't. The jumper barely covers what she needs to cover, and he has never seen her bend over, unless it is for reasons other than brushing off a tablecloth or setting down a drink. She bends over to give special men something to see, those special men who tip well and know how to talk the talk. The jumper has a bib that is nothing more than a square of black cloth smaller than a sheet of typing paper and held up by two black straps. The bib is loose. When she leans into a conversation or to pick up an empty glass, she jiggles inside the bib and may even spill out of it. But it is dark, very dark, and she is not bent over his table, and probably won't, and he cannot see well from where he sits. He gets up from his table near the door because he has no desire to yell out that he wants another bleeding sunset, and he's no longer sure he wants one. He keeps thinking of the bright plastic orange with the green straw, and the more he sees it and remembers his disappointment, the more unfair it is. He stands by the table and reaches into a pocket and pulls out a 20. Money, in the other way, is what it takes, like steak to a dog, he thinks. The redhead clicks over in her little stilt-high pointed shoes, jiggling inside her bib, pumping inside her tight little skirt. Up close, she is old. She is 57 or 58, maybe 60.
You heading out, hon?
She plucks the 20 off the table and doesn't look at him. There is a mole on her right cheek, and it is drawn on, probably with eyeliner. He could have done a much better job.
I wanted another one, he says.
Don't we all, hon?
Her laughter reminds him of a cat in pain.
Hold the phone and I'll bring you one.
It's too late, he says.
Bessie girl, where's my whiskey?
A quiet man asks from a nearby table. Pogue saw him earlier, saw him drive up in a big new Cadillac, a silver one. He is very old, at least 80 or 81 or 82, and dressed in a pale blue seersucker suit and pale blue tie. Bessie shakes and bounces over to him, and suddenly Pogue is gone, even though he hasn't left yet. So he leaves. He may as well leave, since he is already gone. He walks out the heavy dark door, out into the gravel parking lot, out into the dark, out to the black olive trees and palms along the sidewalk. He stands in the dense shadows of the trees and looks at the Shell station across North 26th Avenue, at the big seashell lit up bright yellow in the night, and he feels the warm breeze and is content to just stand for a few minutes, looking. The lit-up shell makes him think of the plastic oranges again. He doesn't know why, unless his mother used to buy the drinks for him at gas stations, and maybe she did. That would make sense if she bought them now and then, probably for a dime apiece when they were driving from Virginia to Florida, to Vero Beach every summer to visit her mother, who had money, a lot of it. He and his mother always stayed in a place called the Driftwood Inn, and he doesn't remember much about it, except it looked like it was built of driftwood, and at night he slept on the same inflated plastic raft that he floated on during the day. The raft was not very big, and his arms and legs hung off it the same way they did when he was paddling around in the waves. And that was what he slept on in the living room, while his mother stayed inside the bedroom with the door locked, the only air conditioner rattling from the window inside her closed-up and locked bedroom. He remembers how hot and sweaty he got, how his sunburned skin stuck to the plastic raft, and every time he moved it felt like a Band-Aid being ripped off, all night long, all week long. That was their vacation. It was the only one they took each year, in the summer, always in August. Pogue watches headlights coming and taillights going, bright white and red eyes flying by in the night, and he looks up ahead to his left and waits for the traffic light to change. When it does, the traffic slows, and then he trots across the clear lane of eastbound traffic and darts between cars in the westbound lane. At the Shell station, he looks up at the bright yellow shell floating high above him in the dark, and he watches an old man in baggy shorts pumping gas at one pump, and another old man in a rumpled suit pumping gas at a different pump. Pogue stays in the shadows and moves silently to the glass door, and a bell jingles as he walks inside and heads straight to the drink machines. The lady at the counter is ringing up a bag of chips, a six-pack of beer, and gas, and doesn't look at him. Near the coffee machine is a soda machine, and he takes five of the biggest plastic cups and lids and walks up to the counter with them. The cups are bright with cartoon designs, and the lids he picks out are white, with a little spout for drinking. He sets the cups and lids on the counter.
"Do you have any plastic oranges with green straws? Orange drinks?" he asks the lady behind the counter.
"What?"
She frowns and picks up one of the cups.
"There's nothing in these. You buying big slurps or not?"
"Not," he says. "I just want the cups and the lids."
"We don't sell just cups."
"That's all I want," he says.
She peers over her glasses to look at his face, and he wonders what she sees when she looks at his face like that.
"We don't sell just the cups, I'm telling you."
"I'd rather buy the orange drinks if you've got them," he replies.
"What orange drinks?"
Her impatience flares.
"See that big cooler back there? What's in there is what we got."
"They're in plastic oranges that look just like oranges and come with a green straw."
Her frown dissolves into a look of amazement, and her brightly painted lips part in a gaping smile that reminds him of a jack-o'-lantern.
"Well, I'll be damned, now I know exactly what you're talking about. Those damn orange drinks. Darling, they haven't been sold in years. Damn, I haven't thought about those forever."
"Then I'll just take the cups and lids," he insists.
"Lord, I give up. Good thing my shift's about to end, tell you that."
"A long night," he says.
"Just got longer,"
she laughs.
"Those damn oranges with the straws."
She looks toward the door as the old man in baggy shorts comes in to pay for his gas. Pogue doesn't pay any attention to him. Pogue stares at her, at her dyed hair as platinum as fishing line, and her powdered skin that looks like a soft, wrinkled cloth. If he touched her skin, it would feel like butterfly wings. If he touched her skin, the powder would come off, just like butterfly wings. Her name tag says, Edith.
"Tell you what,"
Edith is speaking to him.
"I'm gonna charge you 50 cents per cup and throw in the lids for nothing. Now, I got other customers."
Her fingers peck on the register, and the drawer slides open. Pogue hands Edith a $5 bill, and his fingers touch her fingers as he takes his change, and her fingers are cool and quick and soft, and he knows the skin on them is loose, the loose skin that women her age have. Outside in the humid night, he waits for traffic and crosses the street the same way he did minutes earlier. He lingers beneath the same black olive trees and palms, watching the front door of the other-way lounge. When no one comes or goes, he walks rapidly to his car and gets in. Chapter 33.
"You should tell him," Marino says. "Even if it don't turn out the way you think, he ought to know what's going on."
"That's how people head off down the wrong path," Scarpetta replies.
"It's also how they get a head start."
"Not this time," she says.
"You're the boss, Doc."
Marino is stretched out on his bed inside the Marriott on Broad Street, and Scarpetta is sitting in the same chair she was sitting in earlier, but she has pulled it closer to him. He looks very big, but less threatening in loose white cotton pajamas she found for him at a department store south of the river. Beneath the light, soft fabric, his wounds are dark orange with betadine. He claims his injuries aren't hurting as much, not nearly as much. She has changed out of her mud-spattered midnight blue suit and is wearing tan corduroys and a dark blue turtleneck sweater and loafers. They are in his room because she did not want him in her room, so she decided his room was safe enough, and they have eaten sandwiches sent up by room service, and now they are just talking.
"But I still don't see why you can't just bounce it off him," Marino says, and he is fishing.
His curiosity about her relationship with Benton is as pervasive as dust. She notices it constantly, and it gets on her nerves, and there is no use trying to get rid of it. "I'll take the soil samples to the labs first thing in the morning," she tells him. "We'll know in a hurry whether a mistake has been made. If one has, there is no point in my telling Benton about it. A mistake is not germane to the case. It would simply be a mistake. A bad one.
You don't believe it, though.
He looks at her from clouds of pillows she plumped behind him. His color is better. His eyes are brighter. I don't know what I believe, she says. It makes no sense either way. If the trace evidence found on the tractor driver isn't a mistake, then how do you explain it? How could the same type of evidence turn up in Jilly Paulson's case? Perhaps you have a theory. Marino thinks hard, his eyes fixing on the window filled with blackness and the lights of downtown.
I can't think how, he says. I swear to God, I can't come up with anything except what I said in the meeting. And that was just being a smartass.
Who? You? She asks dryly.
Seriously, how could what's-his-name Whitby have the same trace on him that she did? In the first place, she died 2 weeks before he did. So why would he have it on him at all, especially 2 weeks after she got it on her? It don't look good, he decides.
Her spirit recoils, and she feels a sickness that she has learned to recognize as fear. The only logical explanation at the moment is cross-contamination or mislabeling. Either can happen more easily than people might think. All it takes is for one evidence bag or test tube to be placed in the wrong envelope or rack, or the wrong label to be stuck on a sample. This can happen in 5 seconds of inattention or confusion, and then the evidence suddenly came from a source that either makes no sense, or worse, answers a question that could set a suspect free or send him to court, to prison, to the death chamber. She thinks of dentures. She envisions the Fort Lee soldier trying to force the wrong dentures into the dead, obese woman's mouth. That's all it takes, one lax moment like that.
I still don't see why you don't bounce it off Benton, Marino says, reaching for a glass of water by the bed. What would be wrong with my having a few beers, a few hairs of the dog?
What would be right with it? She has file folders in her lap and is idly flipping through copies of reports, seeing if anything she already knows about Jilly and the tractor driver might suddenly tell her something new. Alcohol interferes with healing, she says. It's not been much of a friend to you anyway, has it?
Last night it wasn't.
Order what you want. I'm not going to tell you what to do. He hesitates, and she senses that he wants her to tell him what to do. But she won't. She's done it before, and it is a waste. And she doesn't want to be his co-pilot as he flies like a crazed mad bomber through life. Marino looks at the phone, his hands in his lap, and he reaches for the water. How are you feeling? She asks, turning a page. Need more Advil?
I'm okay. Nothing a few beers wouldn't fix.
That's up to you. She turns another page, scanning the long list of Mr. Whitby's ruptured and lacerated organs.
You sure she's not going to call the cops? Marino asks.
She feels his eyes on her. They shine on her like the soft heat from a lamp, and she doesn't blame him for feeling scared. The accusations alone would ruin him. That is the truth of the matter. He would be destroyed in law enforcement, and it is quite possible that a Richmond jury would find him guilty just because he is a man, a very big man, and Mrs. Paulson is skilled at acting pitiful and helpless. The thought of her sharpens Scarpetta's anger. She won't, she says. I called her bluff. Tonight she'll dream about all the magical evidence I carried out of her house. Most of all, she'll dream about the game. She doesn't want the cops or anyone else knowing about the little game or games that go on in her historic little house. Let me ask you something. She looks up from the papers in her lap. Had Jilly been alive and home, do you think Suze, as you call her, would have done what she did last night? Conjecture granted, but what's your instinct?
I think she does whatever the hell she wants, he replies in a dead tone, the flat tone of resentment and outrage restrained by shame.
Do you remember if she was drunk?
She was high, he replies, high as a kite.
On alcohol or maybe something else in addition?
I didn't see her pop any pills or smoke nothing or shoot up, but there's probably a lot I didn't see.
Someone is going to have to talk to Frank Paulson, Scarpetta says, looking at another report. Depending on what we find out tomorrow, we might see if Lucy would help. Marino gets a look on his face and smiles for the first time in hours.
Holy shit! What an idea! She's a pilot! Let her loose on the pervert.
Exactly. Scarpetta turns a page and takes a deep, quiet breath. Nothing, she says. Absolutely nothing that tells me anything more about Chili. She was asphyxiated and had chips of paint and metal in her mouth. Mr. Whitby's injuries are consistent with his being run over by the tractor. For the hell of it, we should find out if there is any possibility he has some connection to the Paulsons.
She would know, Marino says.
You're not calling her. She does tell him what to do in this situation. He is not to call Susanna Paulson. Don't push your luck. She looks up at him.
I wasn't saying I would. Maybe she knew the tractor driver. Hell, maybe he was into the game. Maybe they have a perverts club.
Well, they aren't neighbors. Scarpetta looks at paperwork in Whitby's folder. He lived over near the airport. Not that it matters, necessarily. Tomorrow, while I'm in the labs, maybe you can see what you can find out. Marino doesn't answer her. He doesn't want to talk to any Richmond cops. You've got to walk into it, she says, closing the file folder.
Walk into what?
He looks at the phone by the bed, probably thinking about beer again. You know what?
I hate it when you talk like that, he says, getting crabby. Like I'm supposed to figure out something from a word or two. I guess some guys would be grateful to know a woman who only talks in a few words.
She folds her hands on top of the file folder in her lap and is somewhat amused. Whenever she's right, he gets cranky. She waits to see what he'll say next.
All right, he says, unable to stand the silence for long. Walk into what? Just tell me what the hell I need to walk into besides the loony bin, because right about now I'm feeling half crazy.
You need to walk into what you fear. And you fear the police because you're still afraid that Mrs. Paulson has called them. She hasn't. She won't. Get it over with, and then the fear will be gone.
It ain't about fear. It's about being stupid, he retorts.
Good. Then you'll call Detective Browning or someone, because if you don't, you're being stupid. I'm going back to my room now, she adds, getting up from the chair and moving it back near the window. I'll see you in the lobby at 8. Chapter 34. She drinks a glass of wine in bed, and it is not very good wine, a Cabernet that has a sharp aftertaste. But she drinks every drop in the glass as she sits alone inside her hotel room. It is 2 hours earlier in Aspen, and maybe Benton is out to dinner or in a meeting, busy with his case, his secret case that he will not discuss with her. Scarpetta rearranges the pillows behind her back, propped up in bed, and sets the empty wine glass on the bedside table next to the phone. She looks at the phone, then looks at the TV, wondering if she should turn it on. Deciding not to turn on the TV, she looks at the phone again and picks up the receiver. She dials Benton's cell phone number, because he said not to call his townhome, and he meant it when he told her that. He was clear about it. Don't call the condo, he told her. I won't be answering the landline, he said. That doesn't make sense, she replied, what now seems months ago. Why won't you answer the phone in your condo?
I don't want distractions, he replied. I won't be answering the landline. If you really have to reach me, Kay, call my cell phone. Please don't take it personally. It's just the way it is. You know how it is.
Benton's cell phone rings twice, and he answers. What are you doing? She asks, staring at the blank TV screen opposite the bed.
Hi, he says softly but distantly. I'm in my office.
She imagines the third-floor bedroom he has turned into an office inside his Aspen condo. She imagines him sitting at his desk, a document opened on his computer screen. He is working on his case, and she feels better knowing he is home, working. It was a pretty rough day, she says. How about you?
Tell me what's going on.
She starts to tell him about Dr. Marcus, but doesn't want to get into it. Then she starts to tell him about Marino, but the words won't come out. Her brain is sluggish, and for some reason she feels stingy toward Benton. She longs for him and feels stingy toward him and doesn't want to tell him much of anything. Why don't you tell me about yours, she says instead. Did you ski or snowshoe?
No.
Is it snowing?
This very minute, yes, he says. And where you are?
Where I am? She is getting annoyed. It doesn't matter what he told her days ago or what she knows. She is hurt and annoyed. Are you asking me generically because you can't remember where I am? I'm in Richmond.
Of course, that's not what I meant.
Is someone there? Are you in the middle of a meeting or something? She asks.
Very much so,
he says. He can't talk, and she is sorry she called. She knows what he is like when he doesn't feel it is safe to talk, and she wishes she hadn't called him. She imagines him in his office and wonders what else he might be doing. Maybe he worries that he is under electronic surveillance. She shouldn't have called. Maybe he simply is preoccupied, but she would rather believe he is cautious than so preoccupied that he can't focus on her. She shouldn't have called. Okay, she says. I'm sorry I called. We haven't talked in 2 days, but I understand you're in the middle of whatever it is you're doing, and I'm tired.
You called because you're tired?
He is teasing her, very subtly kidding her, and at the same time maybe a little stung. He doesn't want to think she called him because she is tired, she considers. And she smiles, pressing the phone against her ear. You know how I get when I'm tired, she jokes. I can't control myself when I'm tired. She hears a noise in the background, perhaps a voice, a woman's voice. Is someone there? She asks again, no longer joking. A long pause, and she detects the muffled voice again. Maybe he has the radio or TV on. Then she hears nothing. Benton, she says. Are you there? Benton? Damn it, she mutters. Damn it, she says, hanging up. End of Disc 8.